being on a river and paddling is a really cool pace to see a landscape and to kind of like move through, because it's slow enough that you're kind of always moving, but it's slow enough that you really get time to see places and to get to see it over a season and kind of see the whole thing end to end and watch it change slowly.
This is the Adventure Sports Podcast, where we talk to athletes, adventurers, and business owners from around the world of adventure sports. Whether you're climbing Mount Everest, starting a bike shop, or getting up off your couch to take your kids hiking for the first time, we want you to have the motivation and inspiration you need to chase that next adventure. The Adventure Sports Podcast is brought to you by Camp Crate, the leaders in fully planned, self-guided backpacking adventures, as well as backpacking gear rental. You can check them out at campcrate.net. Before I knew better, I used to carry cans of food into the backcountry like a doofus. Obviously, I don't do that anymore. I use freeze-dried food, and I really only use Peak Refuel, the best backpacking food, the best freeze-dried food in the world. And if you keep listening to the episode, I can show you how to save 20% off an order if you want some. What's up, everybody? Today's revisited episode is Kurt talking to Heather Hansman about her really cool Green River paddling trip. Really awesome story. You'll enjoy it. But I wanted to make a little announcement before we started. I always have a couple announcements here and there. But yesterday was the best day the podcast has ever had, listenership-wise, which is really cool. So thank you for that. All of y'all are a part of that, obviously. I guess that goes without saying, but thank you. That was really cool to see. So let's keep that up. Let's keep up that motivation for 2019. We want to get this show into as many ears as possible because we think this is valuable content and it's inspiring. And we want y'all to have the best year you can possibly have. Only a week into it. Let's keep this thing up. Thank you so much again. And again, as a reminder, if you'd like to support the show, you can become a patron at patreon.com. You can support the show for $1 a month, $5 a month. I think it's worth it. You know, we're not, you know, Netflix, but we do offer a lot of free content and we work pretty hard on the show. And you can also call and leave a voicemail if you're interested at 812-MAIL-POD. And that's mail like voicemail, not as in the gender. You can also send us an email at any point at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. All right, look forward to hearing from you. And here's the episode.
Hello and welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. This is your host, Kurt Linville. Today I have Heather Hansman with us. And boy, Heather's going to be a fun interview. Heather is a full-time freelance journalist. And in a previous life, she was a raft guide. She was a ski bum and a volunteer ski patrol. And she grew up, actually, back east. She was born in Massachusetts, I believe, and went to college in Maine. But after college, she came to Colorado because she wanted to be the ski bum and enjoy the skiing life. And she got so good at that, she ended up being editor for Skiing Magazine as well as Powder Magazine. So she's really been there and done that. Then she moved to Seattle, where she's been for the last 4 years. But she came back our way last summer and did an epic float trip down the Green River from Wyoming all the way to where the Green joins the Colorado. And that's going to be the main subject of today's show. We're really excited to talk to Heather a little bit about skiing and a lot about this rafting and about a new book that she's putting together about this trip down the Green. So, Heather, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. It is our pleasure. It's a lot of fun to talk to people that are excited about nature and connecting with nature and protecting nature and experiencing nature in the ways that you have. So I'm really glad that you're here today.
Yeah, me too.
Well, give us a little bit of the backstory about, let's start around the moving to Colorado to be a ski bum.
Yeah, I was, like you mentioned, I went to college in Maine and I raft guided kind of every summer while I was up there. And I really, when I graduated, I really kind of had this idea that I wanted to move the mountains and I wanted to be kind of outside all the time. That was like the one priority I had. So a guy that I worked with there in Maine worked at Beaver Creek. So he got me and a couple of my friends from college jobs there, scanning lift tickets, doing kind of like the classic ski bum thing. So two of my friends from college and I moved out to the Vail Valley then, and I have not come back, I guess is really the story of that. And I skied in the winter and then raft guided in the summer out there for a couple of years before going back to journalism school in Boulder.
Wow, that's a lot of fun. You know, I used to do quite a bit of kayaking, which I don't do as much now. I do more canoeing these days. But I always enjoyed it because I would ski in the wintertime, and then when the snow started to melt, I could use that same water again in the rivers when I was kayaking, and it makes a year-round opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. And that's Colorado is the headwaters for a lot of the, you know, like, stuff goes east in the Arkansas and stuff goes west in the Colorado, so, like, Colorado's the big headwaters for most of the country. It's a big layer.
Well, and that's kind of funny because it's where the rivers start. But I grew up in Oklahoma, and I was used to seeing rivers like the Arkansas as it goes through Oklahoma, and it's a large river there, you know. And then the Arkansas in Colorado, you can step across it at its source, right? And then you raft on it through Browns Canyon and below. But I guess the point is a lot of the rivers in Colorado, even though it's the source, they're not as huge as they are by the time they get to other places.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's kind of people don't. You only kind of often see the chunk of river near you. So I think a lot of times that's like a hard perception thing for people to think about a river being different somewhere else and being much bigger or much smaller. You know, rivers change a lot over their course, both in terms of how they flow and in terms of like how much we've managed them and changed them. So I think it's kind of interesting. That's an interesting story to tell.
That's a good point. You know, growing up on the Arkansas and Oklahoma and then being near the Arkansas here in Colorado, I see both ends, right?
Yeah.
But it's a good point because it makes us think more about what a river really is from start to finish. And let's get more into that when we get back to your Green River trip. But yeah. I'd like to come back to skiing first. I know an awful lot of our listeners are thinking, I would love to do the ski bum thing in Colorado. And it's a ton of fun, but what is it really like? How would you describe it?
I mean, it is a ton of fun. And you know, I was 21 when I moved out to Colorado. I was fresh out of college, and that was probably skied every day. And I worked, you know, for $10 an hour and waited tables and, you know, pieced together 10 jobs. And it was a ton of fun. And I'm really glad that it shaped my life in a lot of ways, but I'm really glad that I did it. And my two friends that I moved out to Colorado with, we actually all got together for a ski trip last winter. We went to Silverton, which we hadn't all skied together in a really long time. And one of them just finished business school, and she works for kind of a big marketing firm. And the other one's a college administrator. We're doing really different things, but we all kind of realized that couple years that we spent skiing kind of like shaped us all in a lot of ways, and, you know, made us figure out what we thought was important and kind of our priorities, and made us all really feel tied to the mountains. So I think I would recommend if anybody's thinking about doing it, definitely do it. And it doesn't have to be ski bumming. I mean, I think just like going and finding a way to spend a chunk of time in the mountains is not going to hurt you.
So you said you did that for how long? A couple of years?
I spent 2 years in the Vail Valley and then a year in Summit County.
You're in Summit County.
Yeah.
You know, before we started recording here, we were kind of talking about how the ski industry is changing, and a couple of bullet points for the listeners who may not be aware. Lift tickets are getting very expensive. Ski areas are kind of changing their marketing approach. And it's becoming a little bit more challenging. The barriers to entry are a little bit higher than they used to be. And then it's become such a popular sport that there are issues with crowding, especially on the roads to and from the ski areas. What do you think about the changes in the industry? Is this a positive thing overall, or what would you change about it?
Ooh, I don't know what I can change. I mean, it's sort of a market thing, I think, that, you know, it's getting more expensive because resorts can charge more, because more people are going. I mean, I know in Seattle, where I live now, some of the Stevens Pass this year, which is kind of one of the big areas close to the city, had to turn people away a bunch of weekends because they just couldn't fit people in the parking lot. They couldn't get people on the hill. I think it's kind of a hard squeeze point right now. There's been a lot of consolidation in ski resort management. And even in the past couple of weeks, Vail Resorts has bought up a bunch of ski areas. And I think that makes it easier for them to charge more, and it squeezes out some of the smaller ski resorts. It's an interesting time in skiing right now. I don't have a good answer for what I think is the right way to do things, but I think it is changing a lot. I think climate change is impacting, you know, winter weather and snowpack in a lot of places. I think that's going to be kind of an interesting future battle in how we ski and what that looks like. And I think the rise of backcountry skiing is kind of related to that in a lot of ways, to the kind of like popularity and pricing of skiing. So I think, yeah, I don't have a good answer for how to make it more available and more equitable and open to more people, but I think it is definitely we're in a time of change in skiing, I think, for sure.
Well, I'd like to throw one thought out there, Heather, and you can you can rebut it if you'd like. But my one thought is that it seems that there are a lot of resorts who said, well, with the number of skier days that we're getting now, we could either try to expand the resort to accommodate more skiers, build more lodges, pay for more lifts, and try to get the resort so we can manage the traffic, or we can just raise prices until we start seeing those skier days level off. And then we're going to make more money and not have to build new infrastructure.
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not sure kind of what the, if there are two intentional tracks like that or what the, I do know it's running a ski resort is a hard business, especially because it's so dependent on weather. So I think a lot of, especially kind of the small resorts, you know, there's been a couple in the West, there's been a couple kind of rough winters in the past few years. I think a lot of ski resorts are kind of just trying to get by as best they can. And a lot of that is like raising prices to try and make it work, especially when they're trying to battle out big resorts, you know, kind of like multi-resort groups that have a little bit more leeway in pricing.
Yeah, it's a challenging thing. I guess the reason I mention it is that my perspective may be completely off in left field. That's kind of the feel that I get for it. But I keep thinking that there's an opportunity now more than ever for some of the smaller resorts to be, oh, I don't even know how to say it, but to be the resort that invites the people who don't want to pay for the huge lift ticket prices and make more of a, I'll just say a middle class resort. And skiing has always been a middle class sport, but it's getting more and more difficult for middle class people to afford it these days. So
yeah, and part of that is resort ownership. And I think like East Coast where I grew up, there are maybe more kind of smaller, you know, independently owned resorts, but it's a hard business to make work. And you've seen a lot of those kind of smaller East Coast and Northwest resorts or California, you know, like a couple of the resorts outside of Tahoe that aren't owned by big companies have shut down. So that, yeah, I think there is kind of it's hard to find that middle ground.
Yeah. Well, definitely changing times, changing economy, changing weather. It's a challenging time for the ski industry, no doubt.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is, like, I hope that it doesn't kind of squash the interest or the ability of people to be able to go skiing because they get priced out.
I think that for listeners who want to learn to ski, I don't want to discourage anybody. It's worth it. The prices are extreme, but the sport is still worth it. But the key, I think, is to find a way to get a season pass. Even if you're only going to come and ski for a long holiday, you will probably save money by buying a season pass, you know, the previous fall. So look into that. That's really what makes skiing affordable.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think that might also, depending on the resort, that might push the problem a little bit too. A lot of these kind of big, you know, if you buy a resort pass or something like that, sometimes that pushes people towards the bigger resorts than the smaller resorts. And then the smaller resorts can't compete because they can't offer as cheap of passes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tricky game right now, I think.
Well, regardless, I think that it's worth it. It's worth learning to ski. It's worth teaching your family to ski. It's one of the funnest things. And the skills that you learn in bounds can become skills out of bounds, you know, that you can use as well. And you were just talking about backcountry skiing and how that popularity seems to be growing too. And it is a fabulous sport. So did you do a lot of backcountry skiing?
I did. Yeah, and I did, and I have my dad kind of got into backcountry skiing, and I started doing that in New Hampshire growing up. And then when I moved out west and kind of moved to Colorado, I got much more, where there's kind of more exploring that you can do, I got much more into it. So
I want to move on to the river trip, because I think that's going to be a really fun story to hear. But before we do, one last question. Would you contrast backcountry skiing to resort skiing so that people that have never done either have a sort of an idea of what the differences are?
I would say the big difference between backcountry and resort skiing is that backcountry skiing is much more about the uphill than the downhill. A lot of times you're spending all day skinning up something and climbing up something for, you know, 15 minutes of skiing. So, and then resort skiing is much more about the downhill. You're kind of, and it depends on, I mean, you're outside in both of them, but I think backcountry skiing, often you're much more aware of the environment that you're in, or you're kind of having to pay more attention to it as you're moving through it, because you're looking at snowpack, you're looking at potential avalanche conditions, your route finding. So yeah, I think it's kind of a uphill versus downhill thing.
Yeah, definitely. And the ski areas spend huge amounts of energy and time making sure that their resort is as safe as they can make it. And when you go into the backcountry, it's all up to you.
Yeah, definitely. And then it's important. You have to be, your awareness about where you are and what you're doing has to be much more intentional when you're backcountry skiing.
Yeah.
I think that's a big, big, big part of it.
So, yeah, like I said at the beginning of the episode, I used to carry cans of food into the backcountry. And I know there's a lot lighter things to do, but there's just a lot of options that aren't good for you or are either too heavy. And that's why I really do use Peak Refuel now. They're a new backpacking food company. And I say backpacking food, really, it's just freeze-dried food that you can use for anything. I've actually eaten it for dinner before with my family because it's real food. It's not, it does not taste like backpacking food or hunting food or something that you're only going to eat in the backcountry. It's delicious. High in protein, nutritious. It is going to refuel you. It is filling, huge portions, and I really encourage you all to give it a shot. At least try it out. And that is peakrefuel.com. And if you want to get 20% off an order, use the code ASP20, and that's capital ASP and then 20. Now back to the episode.
Well, let's let the snow melt and get on the Green River. So you last summer, starting in May, spent 2 months going down the Green. And how close to the source were you able to start?
I started in Green River Lakes, which is kind of right at the base of the Wind River Range in kind of central-ish Wyoming, right by Pinedale is kind of the closest town. And it starts, it's not exactly the headwaters. There's kind of a couple... It runs off a peak called Three Waters Peak. But that the lakes were kind of the closest place that I could get a boat into the water. I think you can get a really, you can get a little creek boat or something into the upper part. But I kind of started where it seemed to make the most sense to do it in a boat.
So what kind of a boat did you use?
I used a pack raft for most of the trip. I probably 2/3 of the trip I had a couple sections where I had people along, or I did one chunk with a commercial trip, so we were in a bigger raft. And then I did the last part of the river, which flows into Canyonlands, in canoes with some friends, but most of it has some pack rafts.
So tell our listeners what a pack raft is. We've done several shows about pack rafting, but if they haven't heard one yet, what is a pack raft?
Yeah, I mean, a pack raft is, I mean, it's exactly what it sounds like, I guess. It's a kind of small, light, one-person-sized raft that you can fold up and put in a backpack. So it's really good for getting into kind of backcountry areas or places where the shuttle or the getting into kind of like the point where you might want to start or finish is tricky. And for me, it was kind of a really good tool for the chunks that I was going to be doing by myself, because I could shuttle it and carry it and deal with it by myself. And the one that I have has, it looks kind of like a little, mine's blue, it kind of looks like a little bath, like one single size bathtub basically. But you can store one of the compartments, it's inflatable, and one of the compartments opens up so you can store gear inside of it. So it's kind of a really slick little one lady watercraft.
Very cool. So I love the idea of pack rafting. I think it's the greatest thing. And I was enjoying interviewing people that have combined pack racking with mountain biking.
Yeah.
And they actually put their bike on their raft, and it's a small raft, but they figured out a way to do it. So they would do epic trips where they would go hundreds of miles on river and on biking trail. And I just thought, what a fun thing to be able to do.
Yeah, it's a really cool tool for connecting up kind of different, you know, terrain. I know a lot of people around Seattle where I live will do these kind of like hikes into the Olympic Mountains and float outs. It's a really cool tool for being able to kind of link up different sports and get into some terrain where you might have to cross water and also be climbing over mountains, or also want to ride to cover ground. So yeah, it's a cool, it was really nice to get to spend a bunch of time in it, and I'm kind of excited to get to do more trips in it.
That's fun. So would you recommend a certain brand or model of a pack raft, or?
The one that I don't have a ton of experience with other brands, the one that I have is an alpaca raft. And they're kind of one of the first companies that made pack rafts. They're out of Alaska. It's a family company. And I've been super happy with mine, but I don't have a ton of points of comparison. So yeah, seal of approval, but without much comparison.
Okay. Very cool. You know, a pack raft, because it is packable, there's some limitations, right? It's not going to be as big as a big raft. It's not going to be as maneuverable as a whitewater kayak. It kind of splits the difference depending on which brand or model that you get, I guess. But did you find it was adequate for everything you needed to do on the green?
Yeah, I was really happy with it. When I was first kind of planning the trip, I basically called or emailed people I knew who had done that trip, or, I mean, not a ton of people do the whole green because there's some parts that are pretty flat watery and boring, but a couple of people have, and other people, I, you know, kind of reached out to people who had done similar trips, and one of the guys who had done a lot of it in a canoe was like, oh God, that's going to be terrible. The pack raft's going to be slow. You're not going to, you know, you're going to be fighting the wind. So it probably wasn't the most, you know, it's not the most streamlined, most efficient boat, but it worked out. It was kind of like a really good middle ground for me, and kind of, I was comfortable running it in some white water. I could carry it myself. You know, I could schlep it around. It wasn't maybe super, super fast, but all things considered, it was a really good tool for the trip.
Well, you were a raft guide, so you're very experienced in rafting. And I think that, I mean, obviously that gives you the confidence that you need to take off and do something like this. But for someone who's more of a novice, did you find that the green had some really challenging sections, or was it doable? I mean, to kind of just generally describe how difficult the green is and what the journey's like.
Yeah, the green, I mean, part of why the green made sense for me for this trip, or why I thought it was pretty interesting, is because it kind of has a pretty big diversity of different kinds of water. There are two sections that people run commercially and then run recreationally kind of most commonly, and that's the Gates of Lodore, which is in Dinosaur National Park, and then Desolation and Gray Canyon, which is in kind of northeastern Utah. And those both have some kind of class three. Lodore has some kind of like big class four water. So there are sections that have significant whitewater, and you need permits. You need permits for both of those sections, and they're, especially Gates of Lodore, is kind of a hard permit to get. And then there's some other chunks in the headwaters. There's some kind of like class three whitewater, and right below Flaming Gorge Dam, they call it the A, B, and C section. There's some whitewater in there too. That's a kind of common fishing section. So there are some sections that have, I mean, it's a pretty diverse river as you go along it. There's some sections that have significant whitewater, but then there's a lot of kind of pretty mellow flat water. So I think if you were thinking about doing a trip like this and didn't have a ton of experience, I would be really diligent in your research and figuring out what sections were within the range of water that you'd be comfortable paddling. And American Whitewater, which is kind of the biggest recreational nonprofit for paddling in the country, has a really good, their website's a really good resource for that, for what different stretches of river look like. So yeah, I mean, I think water's a really powerful thing. You know, like if you're thinking about doing something like this, don't push your ability level, especially if you're doing a big solo trip. But there are, you know, there are places where you can find, I'm sure, things that you're comfortable with.
Well, Heather, I'm going to tie in my personal story about kayaking just a little bit. I started kayaking when my wife Ann and I first married, and I loved it. It's an absolutely wonderful sport. And I got to the point that my role was not bomb-proof, but fairly reliable. I could do class four water, but I was more comfortable on class three. But then we started having kids. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get to do it very often, so my skill level kind of plateaued. And what I just described, okay, I can do four, I'm more comfortable in three, I really like something in between. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what happens to a lot of people like that? They reach too far. And I got onto a flooded creek for a day, and I ended up swimming through a boulder field, got really bruised up, and, of course, complete yard sale with the paddle and boat and everything possible that could get scattered, including our throw rope, everything else. Everything's just on as far scattered in the river as you can imagine. And I finally got out of that rapid And I realized that I either needed to do the sport a whole lot more to build my skill or to not take chances like that because I kept on thinking about my kids. Mm-hmm. Water is a powerful thing, and that was a tough swim. I mean, I got pretty banged up, and I just said, you know what? It's not worth it. I'm going to be a dad. Maybe I'll come back and kayak again later in life. But I wanted to share that story because water is very powerful, and maybe I wimped out. I don't know. For me, it was just a choice. It was, I'm going to be a dad first, and I can learn to take on the bigger rapids in a kayak later in life if I want to.
Yeah, I don't think that's wimping out. I think that's making smart choices. I mean, I don't think like being trying to prove something and putting yourself in danger is, like, I don't know. That never seems like a good idea to me. I don't think any kind of recreation is worth putting yourself at risk.
You know, I agree. I always say, you know, do it in a manner so you can come back to do it again another day. Right.
Yeah.
And that's really what it's about for me. And, but I told that story in part because you did a lot of this trip alone. It sounds like, is that right?
Yeah, I did.
So that sounds kind of scary to me in a way. What were your feelings about that?
Yeah, I mean, I had, especially kind of going into it, I had seen some chunks of the river before, but there was a lot that was pretty unknown. And I definitely had a lot of fear around that. I mean, both in terms of like paddling and also just kind of being a woman alone in this landscape that I didn't know. And I got that section I was talking about right below Flaming Gorge Dam, the A section, which is, you know, people fish it somewhat regularly. And that was kind of the first chunk that I did that had rapids that was really alone. And my aunt helped me shuttle that section. She dropped me off at the dam and the river was really high. They had a really big spring and they were releasing a ton of water out of the dam. And they wouldn't let my aunt stay on the boat ramp because we weren't with a commercial trip. So she basically just dumped me and my boat and all my bags. And all of a sudden I was like staring at this big whitewater by myself, totally gripped and
wow.
In this boat. Kind of wasn't sure about. And it took, I mean, I guess that risk thing and putting yourself in a position we were talking about just a second ago, like there's always sort of a like gauge of pushing yourself and what you feel comfortable and what's a good idea. And that ended up being one of my favorite sections of the river. It's really beautiful in there. And I was gripped for a lot of it, but I felt good afterwards. And I think I think I'm a pretty cautious person and I'm pretty, especially in the backcountry and on the river, things like that. And my gauge of where my ability level is, I feel like is accurate to overly cautious. So I was never putting myself in a position where I really, really felt at risk, but there always was kind of the possibility of, you know, like you're dealing with big white water, you are by yourself, something could go wrong. So I guess I tried to never put myself in a risky situation, but that was always a factor. Like that was always definitely there.
Yeah, no doubt. I don't know about you, but what I found is I would get that kind of trepidation as I was getting into a run. And then at the end of the run, I'd be like, I want to go back and do it again right now because now it won't be so scary. I can enjoy it twice as much if I could just go back and do it again right now. Did you feel that way?
Yeah, definitely. And that is kind of I mean, like with skiing, with paddling, with a lot of that stuff, that kind of that space of pushing yourself and feeling accomplished and like you did something and a little bit scared without making stupid decisions and getting yourself in a position where you are actually in danger. Like that margin is an interesting place, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. And it's different for every person and it also changes with experience and skill. So.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, I mean, for me definitely, and a lot of people as you get older, you get more cautious because you know what can happen. You have more people who care about you and worry about you and that you're responsible for. And yeah, I mean, I think that it's an interesting, yeah, it's always an interesting question, I think.
Yeah, definitely. There's a difference. I mean, as an alpine skier, I don't know of an inbound slope that I wouldn't ski, but as a boater, there are tons of water that I won't get near. You know, there are all sorts of runs. It would scare me too much. So I think it has a lot to do with your experience level for sure.
Yeah.
So what was it like 2 months on the river? I mean, I think a lot of people are salivating right now because they're imagining drifting through beautiful canyons and seeing wildlife and just, you know, maybe they did a day trip on a river once and said, oh boy, that was so relaxing. But what's it like to do the whole river 2 months long?
Yeah, it was one of the coolest trips I'll probably ever do. It was amazing. And it's just, I mean, that river changes a lot over its course. You go, you know, I started in May in the mountains in Wyoming and there was still a little bit of snow on the ground and it was cold and you're kind of in this, you know, like scrub brushy forest land, and then you go through, and I hadn't spent a ton of time in southwestern Montana or Wyoming. I don't think a lot of people do. And you're going through rangeland for a while, and then kind of oil and gas land, and then you get back into these beautiful canyons around Flaming Gorge, and then it kind of opens back up into ranches, and then you get into dinosaur and canyon lands, which are some of the most beautiful places in the country. I think being on a river and paddling is a really cool pace to see a landscape and to kind of like move through a place, because it's slow enough that you're kind of always moving, but it's slow enough that you really get time to see places. So I don't know, I feel really lucky that I got the chance to do this and see so much, kind of cover so much ground, and to get to see it over a season and kind of see the whole thing end to end and watch it change slowly. So yeah, I think that and I had family and friends come along for parts of it. And I think even for them, you know, my parents came for a week. I had some friends come along at the end. And I think even to be, for those guys to be out there for a week and kind of float through these landscapes is a really, really cool, really special thing to get to do. So
do you ever start to feel just waterlogged, like you wanted to dry out a little bit?
No, I mean, I think it also, I was in pretty deserty landscapes in, you know, May, June, July. So by the end it was, you know, it was pretty hot and you just wanted to be in the water all the time. Mm. Yeah. I didn't get sick of it. I didn't really get bored. When it ended, I was really sad. Yeah. I didn't get burned out on it, or, you know.
What a cool thing. So did you camp beside the river most of the time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The whole time I had kind of a little tent shoved into my boat, and my, you know, it was kind of like a heavy backpacking setup. Basically, I had a little chair. I brought, an iPad and a solar charger to kind of take notes, because like I mentioned, I'm working on this book about it. Yeah, so it's kind of like somewhere on the line between dirtbag and luxury camping for the whole time.
Nice.
And then when I had people around, it was a little bit, you know, we'd bring a cooler for beer and bring more exciting food and things like that. So
it actually sounds wonderful to me. You're making me want to go do it. But here's a novice question for you. I've done a lot of day trips on rivers, but I've not done extended trips like you're talking about. And one concern that I've had, even just camping near a mountain stream, is what happens if the water level suddenly rises? You're asleep in your tent. Do you take precautions for that, or how do you manage that?
Well, that's actually an interesting question on the green in particular, because most rivers in the U.S. at this point are dam managed and dam regulated, and the Green's kind of an interesting one, because above Fontanelle Dam, which is in kind of southwestern Wyoming, it's totally unregulated. And then in Dinosaur National Park, the Yampa flows in, which is the last kind of major undammed tributary of the whole Colorado River system. So in the Green, there's actually more play in the flows than there are in a lot of rivers. And I think especially I kind of caught it at high flow. For a lot of the stuff that's sort of unregulated, I caught high. So I was more worried about the river going down than the river going up. Mm. But I think you kind of, most sections that people float now, you can look at river gauges and get a sense of where, how they might change and what that might look like. So that wasn't a huge concern on that trip. But yeah, it definitely can be. I was in Texas a couple weeks ago. I paddled the Rio Grande through Big Bend National Park, which is, if people are looking for a cool float trip to do, that is a really, really cool one. And that the whole Rio Grande through there is managed by the Conchas River that flows out of Mexico. It's all dam released. And that can change it can go from like 20,000 CFS to like 200 CFS if they change the dam and you don't hear about it until the river starts coming through the canyon.
Wow.
So that's, yeah, I think it's like a lot of that concern, I think, is knowing what river you're on and what how the conditions can change, and yeah, making sure you have kind of like the knowledge of what the variables might be going in.
Yeah, I can see that. I think on an extended trip like you did down the Green, I guess over time you get a feel for it and a comfort level, but I think I would be hiking way up to high ground every night when I pitched the tent, and probably that would be unnecessary most of the time. Yeah.
And making sure your boat's tied up and if it comes up, it's not going to go anywhere.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think being aware of what could change and what that might look like is definitely important when you're planning. I mean, even just to be out for a night or two, it's definitely important. Well, and I was, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to ask if you could kind of describe a typical day for us. Take us there. What was it like?
Yeah, it was really great. I mean, I would, I planned out the whole trip before I left. I kind of knew the sections that I was going to break it up into and roughly how many miles I wanted to paddle each day and kind of what that would look like. In some sections of it, it's really easy to get maps and you kind of know the features along the river and the kind of where you are all the time. In some chunks you don't. So I would get up in the morning and kind of always have a sense of like how much, approximately how far I wanted to go and what that day might look like, and get up, make oatmeal, blow up my boat, get myself all packed up and, you know, paddle. Usually it's less windy in the morning. So I'm kind of an early riser and, you know, I was out there with the sun kind of being the only factor. So get up, paddle, stop, have lunch, maybe go for a little hike around and explore and get, you know, depending on how much ground I had to cover that day, paddle for the afternoon, find a campsite that looked good, hang out, read. I did a lot of reading, good chunk of writing. Yeah, it was kind of this really nice, like, good chunk of physical activity, good chunk of reading and writing and hanging out and, you know, just kind of exploring a cool place that I'd never been before. So the days were often pretty similar, but good. You know, it's kind of all the stuff that I like to do rolled up in one package.
What about loneliness?
You know, the only times I really got lonely were when I'd had people with me and then they left. That was kind of like, those transitions were often hard. But being out, I was surprised at how not lonely I was when I was out by myself. It was actually really kind of like fun and nice to really be in charge of my own days and only do what I wanted to do. So yeah, I was lonely much less than I thought I would be. And there were definitely times where I kind of wanted somebody around to be like, hey, this is really cool, check this out, or like, isn't that beautiful? But yeah, I never felt, it was more solitude than loneliness, I think. And like, sometimes I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it certainly can be, for sure. And here's a question for you. In our modern world, our pace of life is kind of high. There's
definitely
quite a bit of busyness and trying to, you know, pay the bills and get to work and get home again and take care of the house and take care of the kids. And you know how it goes. It's a different rhythm of living than what you're going to have on the river. How long did it take you to find that natural rhythm and to be able to flow with it instead of fight it?
Oh, I mean, I kind of was really looking forward to being really checked out for this whole chunk of time. And it's crazy how tapped in, like, there were times where I was by myself in the middle of nowhere. I hadn't seen a person in 5 days and like, I could still get cell phone service and check Instagram. So, which I like, you know, hate myself for doing, but was totally doing. Yeah. I think it was really nice to take a break from that and feel like my only obligation was to be paddling downstream. And like, people knew I was checked out. I wasn't accountable on emails or anything like that. Yeah, it's harder to get off the grid than I think you'd think it would be, or it should be, being disconnected and not, and being able to kind of like step into that slower pace and not be, have your phone buzzing or not feel like you have to like keep up on the news of what's going wrong was really, I don't know. I think it's really good for your brain. It was really valuable for me and it was less easy to find than I thought it would be.
Interesting. Yeah. I know that when I go backpacking, it takes a few days before I kind of leave the craziness behind and really begin to connect with where I am and what I'm doing. And so I was just kind of curious. It sounds to me like a river trip would be one of the very best ways to unwind.
Yeah, it is. And it was really, I mean, like I said, I had people along for some of the chunks and some of those were ones where we really didn't get any service. And it was just really nice to kind of be, you know, pull into a campsite, you set up camp, you cook dinner, and then you just have time to hang out with people where you're not, people aren't checking their phones or looking, you know, being like, hey, look at this video. I don't know, like that. Yeah, I feel like that's harder and harder to come by these days, and it feels really important.
Yeah, yeah. I used to leave all of my electronics in the car. I just wouldn't take them with me into the woods, and that was for that reason. That way I wouldn't be tempted, right? But now I tend to use my cell phone as my camera.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that tempts me to take it with me. And but what do you think? Do you think it'd be better if you just left all the electronics at home?
I don't know. Yeah. Like I often try to just like put my phone in, even if I'm just going out for a run or something like that, like, you know, put it in airplane mode or not take it. But yeah, like I use it as my camera. I use it to take notes a lot of times now. yeah, I mean, I think it's like a, it's a good, good and a bad tool, but, and it's a lot of times it's like a self-control thing. If you're not, if you're going to have it with you, are you going to check it? Or are you going to look at it?
Sure.
So, you know that this show is brought to you by Camp Crate, and you hear that name quite a bit, but you might not know exactly what it is. Basically, Camp Crate is the bridge between people who want to have a backpacking experience but don't have gear and don't know where to start with planning. They're extremely helpful. They'll rent you the gear and they ship it right to your front door. If you just have friends that are already going but you just are tagging along but you don't have your own stuff, or you have gear but really don't know where to go, they can help you with all that. So go to campcrate.net or send them an email at support@campcrate.net. Their whole mission is that you get in the backcountry and you have an awesome time on a self-guided adventure.
Well, you did this trip for a reason, not just for fun. You're writing a book about it, and you mentioned before we started here that you learned so much about resource use debate and perspectives and things like that. So tell us, why did you do this trip?
Yeah, I think I had, I mean, like I said, I was a raft guide. I kind of, environmental issues are really important to me, and they're something that I write about a lot. And this kind of idea, you know, if you live out west, the idea of being in drought and kind of water use feels like it's really, it's in the back of the dialogue a lot of the time, but it felt like something that was really, even though it was, I think water is probably going to be the most important resource question of our, you know, like our lifetimes, it felt like it was a really sort of like boring and hard to talk about and like abstract thing. So I kind of wanted, I wanted a way to kind of understand this idea of water use and like why it didn't feel equitable, why we were running out of it, why people were fighting about it. And for me, you know, with my background and also like the way I kind of think about the world, being on the river and kind of seeing how that, how it was actually used felt like a really important way to look at that. And so as I paddled down the river, I talked to, in the headwaters, I talked to ranchers, and then I talked to the people who manage city water in Rock Springs, Wyoming. I talked to the people who manage the dams. I talked to the fish biologists who manage for the endangered fish that are in the river. I talked to other raft guides kind of about how they use water and what the points of debate they're like, what, how they feel like they're, it should be managed in the future and what's gonna happen. And basically we talked about this a little bit before, but kind of like the most important thing that I learned out of all that is that all those people are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to conserve water. They're trying to make sure we're set up well in the future, but their priorities are all slightly different and sometimes they don't align. And that is sort of going to be, I think, the biggest point of debate in water use going forward. And that's kind of what I took away from this big trip, is that everybody's trying to do good, but the solutions and the answers are really, really tricky and really hard to find and take a lot of compromise that doesn't seem, that will be hard to come to, I think.
You know, and in, with population change as well, we have weather changing and we have the population changing at the same time. And, you know, I guess someone could put together some sort of a chart and say that we're headed toward a cataclysmic doomsday eventually, but I don't think we necessarily have to get there at all. But those are real concerns.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, and you can, you mean you can't tell the population to stop growing. You can't tell people to not live in Denver or Southern California or Las Vegas or all these kind of like desert places with low water use that we live in. And kind of the, you know, the smartest, most thoughtful water managers that I talk to, their kind of big picture takeaway is that we do have enough water to go around even as we grow, even as we need to feed, you know, the population is exploding, even as people live, you know, like everyone, there's a lot of people moving to these Western cities. We just have to kind of change the way we use it and allocate it and value it and pay for it. And those are going to be hard. I don't know if it's, you know, political change or market change or things like that, but yeah, we can, it doesn't have to be cataclysmic. It just, we need to change things in a smart, thoughtful way soon. And I don't know exactly what those changes are going to look like or how that's going to shake out.
I think it's interesting, it's fascinating to me anyway, how perspectives have also changed, and I think it's a part of the discussion, but it wasn't that many years ago, call it a couple of generations ago, when the perspective was we have this huge world all of these natural resources that need to be harvested and tamed for the use of humanity, right? That was the perspective. But now we're kind of on the other side of the fence saying, you know what happens when you dam up a river? You know what I mean? And so to get the balance between those two extremes.
The dam thing is a really, really interesting one and a really tricky one, I think, because most of the places that we live in the Western U.S. wouldn't be livable if it wasn't for dams and water storage and us being able to kind of control how we get water and when we get it and how quickly it comes to us. And so that's shaped, you know, like how we live now in a lot of ways. And dams have also really had these like, huge catastrophic impacts on ecosystems. And so, but I think you have to kind of work within what we have now. Like we can't just, if we ripped out all the major dams and let the rivers be free flowing, we wouldn't be able to live in a lot of places that we, the kind of buzzword, I think in a lot of science and ecosystem management is adaptive management and trying to kind of work within these systems that we built up, these big dams, things like that, to try and make sure we are restoring ecosystems as much as we can. We're protecting animals and, you know, plants and things like that. And we're also protecting humans, you know, and like making sure that people can live where they do live. So yeah, there's not, sure you can fault past generations for damming rivers and ripping up forests and things like that, but the reality is that we kind of have to deal with what we have in front of us.
Yeah,
trying to do that so that we can.
You know, there are a couple of what I think are kind of fascinating points. My son Daniel was asking about population growth this week, and I just pulled up the Worldometers Info World Population Clock so that I could speak a little bit more intelligently. But here's the crazy thing: a lot of people may not know. Since I was born, the world's population has more than doubled. And that kind of blows my mind because I think of it as a historic problem, right? Not something that happens in half a lifetime. And I'm not really that old. So it blows my mind to think that. Another thing that a lot of people don't realize is that China has the most populous country, and then comes India, and then comes, guess who's next?
Is it us?
It's us, the United States. And part of that's because we're a large landmass. You know, we can hold a lot of people. But that said, we're still less than a quarter of what India has. So, but there's a big space there. But the United States is actually now the third most populated country on Earth. Fascinating and growing very, very quickly.
Oh yeah, and when it comes to water use stuff, like we have to feed all those people and, you know, take care of them.
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges. And maybe we'll come up with some wonderful breakthroughs with clean energy and better farming techniques and better resource management so that everyone can live a better life and we can care for nature better than we have been. I mean, that's the goal to me.
Yeah, no, I think so. And it's a hard goal that takes a lot of compromise and a lot of kind of getting people who think differently in the same room to talk about things. And it's going to be a lot of tiny, tiny battles, I think, to keep working forward and making sure we're doing things sustainably in a way that we can keep doing it and keep living here.
Oh yeah, no doubt. There's one other thing I'd love to say and we'll come back to the water. But what I found really interesting is that recent studies have found that the best way to manage the world's population is to increase the standard of living for the developing nations. And the reason for that is that rather than trying to do population control, they have found that when people know that they're going to be cared for in their old age, when people know that their children are not going to die, you know, with a high infant mortality rate in their country, when they know that, you know, their children can be educated, and as the society moves into a more, just a higher standard of living in general, people naturally back off on the number of children that they're having. And it's interesting because the rate of growth of the world's population is slowing down now because of that. It's a good trend. And, you know, people were pushing the panic button about 20 years ago saying this is really, really bad. But if we continue on the way that we're going, the world's population is going to level off and hopefully at a sustainable level, although I'm no expert on that. But it's just something worth thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, this is definitely not my area of expertise either, but I think that is like a really important kind of like plug for globalization and plug for countries like America that have a good program doing that, for doing foreign aid and bringing information about healthcare. And hopefully we can kind of take the lessons that we've learned in the U.S. over the past several hundred years about, you know, industrialization or all these things, you know, healthcare and things like that, and then bring them to develop countries so they can faster than we did and can kind of help that population curve.
Yeah. And it's fun to think that by helping people, you're actually helping the planet. That's what I like. It doesn't have to be adversarial, right? It can be a matter of everybody working together and helping each other out and actually helping the environment at the same time. So I think it's a really positive thing. And I guess as you were running the river here, that kind of became part of the experience, was thinking about resources, especially water resources. Did you take away any changes of heart or huge insights that you would like to share?
I think the biggest insight or the biggest thing I had been small-minded about going into it is that, like, a lot of people who think really differently from me and come from really different perspectives, you know, these kind of big cattle ranchers or, you know, people working in the oil and gas fields or things like that, for the most part, are trying to do good. I think it's going to take a lot of compromises and a lot of kind of bringing in multiple different perspectives to figure out a way that works a little bit for everybody. And, like, obviously, you know, nothing's going to work perfectly for every single person or even for one group, but it's going to take a lot of compromise, a lot of trying to get people talking to each other and finding some middle ground. So yeah, people who think differently than you are not necessarily wrong or trying to screw you over, I think, is the big takeaway.
Maybe we all just need to know each other better. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
You wrote an article for the Smithsonian that was talking about getting water managers on the YAMPA. Just give us a real brief overview of what that was about. It's kind of a neat idea.
Yeah, it's actually a really cool program. The YAMPA, they call it the YAMPA River Awareness Program, and it's the Friends of YAMPA, which is a nonprofit group out of Steamboat Springs. And the YAMPA is the last, I think I mentioned it earlier, it's the last undammed tributary of the Colorado and kind of one of the last major undammed rivers in the western U.S. And so a lot of people, there's been a lot of kind of proposed projects trying to dam it and divert water to the Front Range of Colorado and things like that. It's sort of endangered. So this group every year brings out, I mean, they bring some journalists, but they also bring water managers and ranchers and people who work for power companies and government. You know, when I was there, the guy who's the head of Denver Water was there, and somebody from a former interior secretary and a guy who runs the National Parks Foundation. They take all these people out on the river to kind of, and, you know, you sit in boats for 5 days and talk about what you think is the smartest way to manage the water. And I think it's this really powerful tool of getting people together and talking about it in a, like, low conflict zone to kind of think about what might hear other people's perspectives and then think about what might work for everybody. And so that trip was actually a pretty big part of me wanting to do the Green River trip and kind of wanting to think about all the different aspects of water management and how they get along and how they don't and how it might shake out in the future.
Yeah, I think that is so cool. It's easy for someone that's far removed from something, you know, that's in a building somewhere in an air-conditioned room with no windows to make decisions or have ideas about how something is. But you put them actually out on the water together and you say, okay, you're not in your office anymore. Now you're on the water. Let's talk here. I love that context.
Like, you're not this jerk, you know, like small-minded jerk that I thought you were. You're actually this, like, smart, thoughtful person who is trying to do this for a reason. Yeah, I think there's a lot of power in that, those kinds of conversations and trying to get people on the same page.
I love it. Yeah, I love what you're doing to help people to kind of gain that awareness and that understanding, that perspective. It's a beautiful thing. So your book that you're writing, it's not out yet. It's called Running the River. It's coming out not this fall, but next fall. And it's going to be published by University of Chicago Press. Is that right?
That is all correct, yeah.
Okay. So why the title Running the River?
It was sort of a play on words of the idea of me kind of paddling the whole river, and then also the idea of who's in charge of the water and who runs the river, you know, kind of from a management, from a kind of like water use perspective. So hopefully it's funny.
So is the majority of the book about your trip itself, or is it more about resource management, or is it a nice combination of the two?
I tried to make it a nice combination of the two, I think, of the two rather. I mean, the idea was kind of to use the trip and what I saw and kind of who I talked to on the way to give a little bit of on the ground perspective about some of these debates that I think often can be sort of boring or wonky or hard to wrap your mind around. So hopefully it's a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of that kind of travel narrative, but then there's also this kind of, you know, reported kind of issue based stuff too. So hopefully a blend, enough action to keep it interesting, and then enough, you know, policy to give people who maybe aren't totally dialed into water use issues some context on what's going on and what could potentially happen.
So as a freelance journalist, you have a huge portfolio of writings. I can't begin to cover it all, but I want to encourage our listeners. There's a lot more to these stories, and Heather has written about so many things, not just about resource management on the river or this river trip, but so much in skiing and biking and other things. If you go to heatherhandsman.com, then she has a beautiful portfolio there of all these writings. And Heather, I don't know, it looks like there are probably 50 or something different articles and essays and writings that are linked on your site here. So I would encourage our listeners to go be a part of that.
Yeah, that'd be great. And I'm a little bit tardy in updating it sometimes. So I feel like I'm a little more on top of that, which is H. Hansman, if people want to see that. But yeah, people, you know, it's always kind of interesting to see. This is the cool thing about being a writer, is that you forget sometimes that people actually read your things and get stuff about it. So I love hearing from people, and you know, that's the cool part about it.
Well, I think it's really fun, and I'm just going to spell the website. It is Heather, H-E-A-T-H-E-R, of course, but the last name is Hansman, H-A-N-S-M-A-N. So it's not hand, but hands, Hansman. So heatherhansman.com, and that's where you can find a whole lot more information about what Heather is up to and all of her writing, and it's a really great resource. So Heather, thank you for putting that out there for us.
Oh yeah, thanks for chatting with me and having me on. This has been really fun.
You bet. And for all of our listeners out there, as always, get out there and have some fun. This time, consider a raft trip. Think about going down a river for a while and gaining some of the perspectives that Heather was sharing with us.
Hey, thank you so much for listening. If you know somebody that would make a good guest on the show, or if you have a pretty cool story about the outdoors or adventure sports that you want to tell us, please call us and leave a voicemail at 812-MAIL-POD. That is 812-624-5763. You can also send us an email at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. Again, it is always helpful to leave us a review on iTunes. And if you'd like to be a supporter of the show, you can give $5 a month at patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. And links for all that stuff is also in the show notes. So thanks again for listening. And y'all get out there and do something so you can be on the show one day. All right, later. Also, don't forget, if you want to save 20% off the best backpacking food on planet Earth, go to peakrefuel.com and at checkout, use the code ASP20.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.